The whole truth contains all statements whatever about all formal possibilities and relations. Beyond truth here, there is nothing. And that nothing is simply the negation of a thing. We can say that the whole truth of macrocosmos, is, if we like, a body of truth. This is the Logos body of Christ. When Christ says, I am the truth, I am the way, the truth, and the life, I am the truth, he says. When he's saying this, he's referring to the whole cosmic body of ordered forms. Now, beyond this cosmic body of ordered form, there is no thing, no form, no order. There is an infinite abyssal force, sentient power, utterly unordered. It is no thing, because thing implies that the spirit is crucified and grossly substantiated. TH into G. Thing. So the whole cosmic body of truth is the Logos body of the cosmic Christ. In Buddhism, this would be called the Dharmakaya, the body of Dharma or law. The great enlightened sages in the Buddhist hierarchy are said to have attained the Dharmakaya of the Buddha, that is to say, the law body of the Buddha. But this law body is just the same thing as the Logos body of the cosmic Christ. And the text here says, rightly dividing the word of truth. This means that the word of truth, although it's a whole, can actually be divided. It does not mean that we can sever the thing and separate the parts and throw them away from each other, but it means that we can intellectually separate the various implications of the whole law. And the first thing about this law is to recognize that it comes out of no thing, out of no being, out of the non-being of the abyss, into being. Being we represent with the circle, which is a force closing itself, and the force on which we can conceive no bigger, the macrocosmic force, is the closed power, the body of the Logos. This is the whole truth. When we come to look at it, we find this whole truth has two aspects, a fixed, eternal aspect, and a differentiating or changing aspect. And we have to divide the truth correctly, rightly dividing the truth. We divide it rightly in this way. First, we say it is made of fixed elements and of changing elements. The fixed elements correspond with Plato's eternal forms. The changing elements correspond with the forms of the Heraclitean flux, the world of changing energies. But the whole truth contains the fixed, eternal, and the changing temporal. So that if we divide the whole truth in this way to begin with, into fixed elements and changing elements, we have already made the first step towards rightly dividing the truth. On the fixed side, we can place all geometrical forms, whatever. Triangles are eternally three-sided. And a right-angle triangle in the ideal world has a right angle that is a right angle. But at the technical schools, when a student makes a right angle, it may or may not have the right number of degrees. So in the temporal world, the triangles made by man may be measured carelessly. The right angle may be less or more than the right angle. So in the temporal world, there is a possibility of error. The triangle will have three sides, but the angles may be distorted, or the lines may not be true lines. They may not be straight, they may be bent. And then you get a funny kind of triangle that isn't very easy to recognize. In the temporal world, all the forms can be distorted. In the eternal world, they are not distorted. So we have then two worlds here, the conceptual world of pure forms, which cannot change, the right angle with the appropriate number of degrees, and the temporal world, where they do change, and may have fewer or more degrees than they should have. How do we apply this fact to helping people who need help? We said before that the man is a microcosm. Like the macrocosm, and therefore the same diagram will serve to illustrate a man. A man must have in himself something fixed and something different. I put the T at the top here on purpose for a moment, and at the bottom I put the R. By the T, I mean all fixed forms, that is, geometrical and mathematical propositions, which do not change because they are matters of definition. The definition of a triangle does not change. We keep these in our head, in what we call the intellect. But down below, in the belly land, we have strange rumblings and differentiatings of force. These forces are temporal forces. The force of sex is a force that's coming out, differentiating in the world, making lots of children, and these children are coming into relation and fighting and so on. Conflict arises from differentiation. In the eternal world, where the triangle is a triangle cannot fight, in principle, with another triangle. They both have three sides, and squares have four sides, and circles, and so on, all have their own characters. They do not fight at all. But in the temporal world, these same things distorted can and do fight. So that we have in the human being, the microcosm, we have some fixed elements which don't fight, but all men will agree this triangle has three sides, and they don't argue about that. But they may very well argue about which triangular piece of garden belongs to which man, because that is a temporal proposition. Now, between this eternal fixed form and this differentiating energy, there is a fact. The eternal fixed form wants to shout out all the time, triangles are triangles, squares are squares. But the differentiating energy in the temporal world is taking any given square and running a saw across it and saying it isn't a square, it is two triangles. In the temporal world, we can and do interfere with forms, and by using our saws or our analytical power, we can and do cut into the physical representatives of these ideal forms and alter them. With a prep saw, we can cut out any shape out of any other shape. And this fretting process with the prep saw is very similar to the fretting process in the mind, where the individual is fretting because he's trying to cut out of the whole reality a little piece to please himself, and somehow it doesn't fit with the other pieces other people are cutting out. These eternal forms which are shouting out that they are what they are, A equals A, which is the type of it, and down here there are differentiating forces that say, well, you may think that A is A, but I'm going to put two little feet on it and a head and pretend it's a portrait of my Uncle George. This kind of distortion of eternal fact is conducted by temporal energies. And a man has these differentiating energies inside himself, and they are in conflict with his eternal formal content. And truth contains both. Now the intellectualist error is to pretend that the eternal form is valid and the temporal energy differentiations are invalid. We know that Plato believed, certainly in his younger days, that the eternal forms were the type, pattern of things on earth, and that you could actually apply these eternal forms in the world. What he found in his own attempts at political temporary was that he just couldn't make it. His eternal forms truly were eternal, but he could not persuade anybody in the temporal world to sit upon them and keep their positions. And so in the same way, if we want to help someone, then we can only help them with the truth. Somehow the whole truth has to be stated. That time is not a villain opposed to eternity, absolutely. Time has a function that's equally valid, and time is a part of truth. The mere fact that that truth is taken out of the word of Torah, which is the same thing as the rota, says that time is a wheel. That wheel has a still center and a whirling perimeter. It stands still and it changes. And all of this is truth. Certain religionists think that eternity is true and time is false. The Platonists thought eternity is true and time is false. And then they made the error of trying to impose the true on the false. That is, imposing eternity on time. They didn't manage to do it. Confucius in China had the same idea. He was given the territory to govern, and he made a mess of it. Because he tried to apply his static self-evident A is A to highly dynamic energies differentiating in the world, and yet won't conform. To help people, then, we have to give them the whole truth. The whole truth, rightly divided into fixed and differentiated. The differentiating arising up to expression, and the fixed are saying change is impossible. Here in the top is Parmenides saying change is impossible, it does not exist. Zeno is making his silly paradoxes to show that the flying arrow stands still. You shoot him dead with it, but he still thinks he's standing still. Down below, the differentiating forces of the temporal world appear, and they rise up to express themselves, and the eternal forces press on them. And between the two, in the zone of conflict of the feeling, is the no man's land, the place of emotional conflict. To help people, then we then have to tell them this whole truth. A living, existential human being is a battlefield. He's a battlefield between eternal propositions, absolutely immobile, eternally static triangles and circles and squares, and a biological energy, a temporally expressing energy, down below. Both of these things are parts of truth. The whole truth embraces the whole of eternity and the whole of time. It is incorrect to say that time is all wicked and eternity is all charming. It is incorrect to think that you can earn eternity by behaving well in time. If you think that time and eternity are different, then automatically you are falsifying your action. Jacob Burma said this when he said, "He to whom time and eternity are the same, he has finished his work." To see time as serially expressing the content of eternity, to see time as showing nothing except the expressed relations of eternity, is to see time correctly. What is the purpose of differentiating of force, differentiating of universal powers? The answer is very simple. If we don't differentiate them, then they are non-differentiated. If that is so, there are no individuals. No individual human beings, animals, vegetables. No individuals, no relations. No relations, no value. So the serial differentiations of forces are necessary bases of values to differentiation. On the other hand, if these differentiating forces exist alone, they have no synthesizing forces to act upon. But the forces that can synthesize and give sense to these differentiating forces are the eternal forms, which are concepts which enable us to group adequately the temporal serial forces of the world. Every man has a lot of time down in the belly land. He eats food into the belly. He appears in a family in the belly and is determined to make another family in the belly. He has these three centers, these three zones. They're all to do with time. Eating food has to do with time. Coming from a family has to do with time. Making another family has to do with time. Down in the belly are all these temporal processes. If we cut off the belly completely, we deprive the whole man of necessary energies. Saw the man off below the diaphragm and see how he fares in his other remaining processes. Because of the essential nature of these serializing temporal forces down below, St. Paul said, first a physical body, then a spiritual body. You cannot become a spiritual body without first becoming a physical body. The physical body, matter, is the center of reaction whereby spirit becomes conscious of itself and is enabled to reach the reflexive self-consciousness through its own activity. Without the physical body, reflexive self-consciousness is an impossibility. When it says God so loved the world, it means the world has a function for God. Some careless theological thinkers have thought God, he is omnipotent, he doesn't need the world. But if they say that, then he makes something he doesn't need. This depends on the definition of the word need. If need implies a lack, they say God can lack nothing. Therefore, he can do quite well without the world. But if this omnipotent, omniscient God bothers to make something that he has no use for, he shows himself at least a non-utilitarian. In fact, the book says he loved the world. This world has a function for him. Let's see what happens. We draw a little circle to represent the world. We shade it dark to show that it's material. Now, beyond this world, this macrocosmic sphere, this is not just earth, it's all matter whatsoever, all substance. Beyond it is an absolute and eternal flux of energy. Remove this world, and that flux just flows eternally and infinitely. Put that stone in the middle of it, that material sphere, and this flux hits against it and is reflected back. Somehow that center, by its reflective power, forces spirit to become aware of itself. The physical body has a definite function. The symbol of that physical body as substance, in Burma's terms, is Luna, the moon. Substance, the seventh form of the casket that contains all those possibilities. The moon is the simple reflector of the sun's light, symbolizes this. Itself has no light, and yet the energy of the spirit hitting on it is bent back from it, and in that back bending, spirit can become conscious of itself. Now let's imagine for a moment we have a man and he's in trouble, and we say to him, what kind of trouble are you in? And he says, I only wish I knew. It's quite a usual thing. I don't know. I've got a headache, a backache, a bellyache, and so on. Well, we say, all right, your problem must necessarily be a problem of eternal values and of temporal activities. Somehow, if you're being problematic, you cannot be merely a belly rushing about, indulging itself. Something must have stopped you. Otherwise, you wouldn't be problematic. There's something you want to do and something stopping you doing it. We have to find out what it is that's stopping you and what it is you want to do. If we can find out what you want to do and find out what is stopping you doing it, we're already halfway to return to normal. If what is stopping us doing a thing is an eternal and valid form, then we're right to be stopped by it. But if what is stopping us is not an eternal form, but something derived from below, which through mere pain has frightened us and made us, through the pain, afraid to act, then it is not valid. And yet Solomon said the beginning of wisdom is the fear of the Lord. By Lord he meant principle of order. Down below we've said before many a time, the belly is a simple, straightforward urge, unthinking, blind and determined to get what it wants. It never sees anything in its way, it just goes at it. But sometimes there are things in its way that are brick walls. And the force hits against the brick wall, and instead of going straight through it, it's a very good brick wall, this one, the force hits it, bounces off, and then turbulates behind it. This turbulation it experiences as a kind of distress. It intended to go for a certain object over there, and it has been stopped. There we have our letter T. The force and the stopping force. Behind that wall, turbulation occurs. That zone of turbulation appears in the three-part man as the chest. The forces from below climb up, they're met by the forces from above, and the zone of turbulation, emotion, appears. Basically, the problem for any man is the same as for any other man. He has a will, and if he has a problem, his will has been crossed. His will has been thwarted. The question is the thwarting of his will legitimate in the cosmic sense, or is it simply a thwarting of his will by another temporal force with no eternal justification whatever? Let's have a look what eternal justification is. The white paper represents spirit. That is all there is. There's nothing else. Any mark we put upon the paper represents a motion of that spirit. So if I do a little wiggle, it means the paper is vibrating. If I do a circle, it means the paper is moving around. I draw a circle. That circle represents a motion of the spirit. There is nothing other than this spirit. This spirit is the absolute sentient power, which is the Godhead. The big circle that it makes is the only begotten Son of God, the only begotten, the unity begotten, the supreme unity, the unity within the non-being. This is the supreme being, and beyond it the non-being. Within this closed sphere, there's a different kind of process going on than the flux beyond it. Within that closed sphere, the forces of spirit are reflected in sound, and their directions are determined by the shape of the sphere. So the sphere is traversed by the forces within it, and the perimeter of the sphere reflects them back always internally. So the internal process of reflection is something like the external one, except the internal one is continuously fed back within it, giving rise to individuated reflexive self-consciousness. Now, in the book of Genesis it says, God fashioned man as to his body from the earth. And then he breathed into man something of God's spirit, and man became a living soul. Man did not get a soul, man is a soul. Man became a living soul. And that in man which is conscious, which is able to follow an argument, is not other than God. Inside this drawn circle representing a rotating of spirit, there is still some white paper not drawn upon. That white paper is the same white paper that is outside. Outside it is the Godhead. Inside the circle it is God immanent. And no matter how many circles we draw inside this first circle, there is always inside the circle necessarily some of that spirit, and that is the immanent spirit. Now, wherever there's a circle, we say the spirit has become ensouled. Wherever there is a circle, there is a soul. Now, if you look at the paper, you'll find that the paper in this circle and the big circle and this circle and so on, regardless of the size of the circle, the paper within the circle is always exactly what it was before. So we say that the infinity of God in its essence is unchangeable. This means that the central intelligence in every being, in the worm and the donkey and the human being, in every being there is the same paper shining through. The differentiating factor on these beings is form, but the essence of them is God's Spirit. And there is nothing other than God's Spirit plus action. This world is a world of action. It is an actual world. Remove actuality and we all disappear. Put actuality back and we have a world. But the actuality is only the activation of God's Spirit by God's Spirit. So in a real sense, this world, even this material world, is God. The difference between this and pantheism is very simple. In pantheism, the statement is made that nature is God. Whereas in this statement, we do not use the word nature beyond this circle, because nature is natura, and that tura tells you that there is a circle there. So nature is still only a circle, and beyond this circle is an infinity of spirit. Whereas pantheism sees nature as God, this sees nature as only one of the manifestations. And beyond this nature, there's an infinity of sentient power of the Godhead. So this is not pantheism. And yet inside every individual human being, there is the intelligence of God. Now let's have a look at it biologically. Here is the first egg from which all human beings derive. Inside it, it has a nuclear center from which all the orders are given to develop it. If we take a knife and cut a piece of this egg off, then the part where the nucleus is not, when we cut it, quickly dries up, disintegrates, has died. But the part on the side where the nucleus is heals, and it makes itself a complete egg again, which demonstrates that the nucleus has an intelligent power of building form, and it has a pattern. It builds itself again like it should be. This nuclear center in the egg is therefore the doorway for spirit. Now, we know that the human race multiplies by dividing. The egg, to divide, first of all divides its nuclear intelligence, and when it's separated the nucleus, then it puts a wall between it. And when it's put the wall between itself, it starts a pinch movement. It makes itself wasted until it's nearly separated, and then it finally separates. We now have two eggs, and they both have nuclear central intelligence. And the central intelligence in each egg is exactly the same as in the other one. Now, in terms of modern psychosomatology, you can say, there is the egg, there is the nuclear center of intelligence, that's the immanent spirit, and that's the psyche. And between that inner circle and this outer circle is the soma, or body. Now, modern psychosomatics knows certain things it didn't know 30 years ago. It didn't even know the implications of this fact. If you cut a piece off the egg, the part away from the nuclear side disintegrates and dies, and the part on the nuclear side repairs and reformulates. Somehow the psyche has power over the soma. This is a fact. So from that psyche we have to see the spirit going in and then going into the body to give orders. It has that power. The spirit is the eternal intelligence of the absolute. It never acts inefficiently. It is its essential nature to know what it's doing. it is eternal wisdom. This being so, we should expect that the soma, the body of a being, is always in perfect health, because the orders coming through the immanent center, through the psyche, into the soma, are always true orders, and they always put the thing into its optimal state. How then do people get out of order? The answer is very simple. There are other finite beings in the world too. And there they have the possibility, when they come into contact, of contingent relation, where the messages from center into soma there, and center to soma here, although they're busy ordering their own somas correctly, in the collision of somas, a new kind of motion is introduced, the motion of contingent stimulation. Now, the psyche, this field awareness, has a power of centering itself anywhere within its being. You can concentrate on the tip of your nose, or on your navel, or your big toe, at will. And so, the psyche can concentrate its attention on the zone of contingent stimuli. It can actually identify with an incoming physical stimulus. When it does so, if it does so very, very strongly, it forgets that it is a centralized being, and it becomes eccentric. It goes into the soma and believes then that it is merely a somatic being. It becomes a mechanistic behaviorist. It forgets it has a center of initiative, and is then driven about to try to find an equilibrating entity on the outside to balance it, when the real forces of balancing are on the inside. Now, all diseases, whatever, spring out of this fact. Contingent relation identified with overthrows central authority of spirit. That is the cause. Now, let's remember, we draw two eggs in their nuclear intelligences. We remember that they are subdivisions of the human egg from which they all derive. We will now pretend that one of these is a man and the other is a woman. And they come into relationship. Now, they come into relationship primarily because they're driven to by non-individuating forces. Because spiritual intelligence itself has a purpose. The private individual pursuing contingent comfort in the world may have his own particular purpose. If this purpose does not coincide with the purpose of spirit, then he is going to fail, not it. God is not mocked means that the private purposes of individuals cannot overthrow the purpose of God, of spirit. When they come into contingent relation for comfort motives, they're coming together for the wrong reason. The absolute spirit has precipitated a world in order to produce reflexive, self-conscious beings. When it divides the egg, it wants to produce, again, reflexive, self-conscious beings, freely able to make their own decisions. So that in the center, there's a will coming through to be free. A will coming through to be free. There's a very, very deep will in every human being to be free. And that will cannot be stopped. But if we shift the accent from the center of being into the somatic region, into the body, into a comfort mechanism or a material ambition, if we do that and forget the center, we forget the deep will to freedom. And we then abandon the concept of freedom and become, in reactivity, somatic beings, that is, mere material entities. The next thing is then to try to appropriate another being as part of our comfort mechanism. I'll keep this quite simple. I'll draw the two beings again, and we'll draw the relational possibilities. The ideal relation is from center to center. Both centers are sensitive, and they know exactly what the other one is doing, so they don't bash about on their perimeters and to continue excess energy application destroy each other. They feel each other's inner intent and adjust to it. That is very rare. That's the hypothetical relationship of yogi and yogini in the Yab-Yum of the Tibetans. Now, another kind of relation, much more common, is when an individual believes himself to be a free being, but is really identified with a somatic zone concept of comfort or material success. Through this zone, any energy from center is filtered and then imposes itself on the body of another being. It then treats the other being's body as a means to its own end. This is the thing that Kant said is very, very wrong. Kant must have borrowed it somewhere. He said you must never use another being as a means to your end. It's been said a few thousand years before him, but he said it in a nice, complicated way which made people think about it. Whereas when it was said simply, they thought it was too obvious to think about. But when it came to this categorical imperative that you must not use another living being as a means to your end, he was simply stating this. You cannot ignore the central intelligence of another being, if there is a central intelligence there, and appropriate its body to your service without a reaction from center. The man who kissed the prostitute and got a kick on the shin for being familiar will understand that. Because when he appropriated the body, he omitted to notice there was, even there, a central spirit that said, this is not what you paid me for. And so, even at the, in inverted commas, lowest levels, spirit works and comes out with its own contribution. It is utterly impossible for any being with a central intelligence to appropriate the body of another being without that other being reacting against it, because of the central impulse of freedom coming from it. Anybody who then, looking at that diagram and thinking there is such a thing as conjugal rights, they spell it in the variety programs, they lengthen the middle syllable for phonetic reasons, they conjugal. Anybody who thinks there are any such things as conjugal rights is just lacking in clear perception. There are none whatever. And if a man, finding his wife in the wrong state, as he would say, reminds her that she is married to him and that he bought her a ring, possibly even an engagement ring, since porn. If he reminds her of that and expects an immediate, spontaneous pair of arms around the neck, without a rolling pin, then he'll be very lucky man. The spirit of freedom is coming through. It's coming through both entities. Now, most of the problems of human beings, apart from being run over by accidental buses, resolve down quite simply into this. A is trying to appropriate the body of B and utilize the body of B as part of its comfort mechanism and part of its ambition. And because of the spirit working through B, B is kicking against it. And because of internal untruths, what Kaiserling called basic ill will, there's a great determination not to see that this reaction is in the name of freedom. The A who is trying to appropriate the B is identified with the concept of comfort and success in the material world, and that concept treats every other body as a means to its end. Now, he doesn't want to admit this, because if he does admit it, he will have to abandon the whole of his purpose. And he doesn't want to abandon his purpose, because his purpose is the amount of his energy of will which he has put into that concept. So, we find, in fact, that practically all the problems of human beings arise because A is trying to appropriate the body of B and force the body of B to obey it. And in the center of B, there is spirit kicking against it. Now, in B, there may be, and often is, also a concept of material security. And this security makes, perhaps, B accept a lot of the imposition that A places upon it. It accepts a tremendous lot. It accepts it, perhaps, for years. And then, quite suddenly, at the end of those years, B says, I can't take any more. And by this statement, admits that it has been under strain, and has been inconsistent. And it says, there is a limit to what I can endure. And this is the voice of freedom speaking through the centre again, and saying, in the name of your comfort, you cannot accept this imposition of the comfort mechanism of another being. Somewhere you will have to stand and insist on being internally self-determined. And that is the basic problem of human beings, the appropriation of the body of one being or more to the purpose of another. And the thwarting of the will of A by the behaviour of B is A's problem. Now, human beings have three parts, and so we can carry the help to those needing it further. We can say you have three purposes down in the belly. The purpose of securing sexual relations for yourself, for pleasure and procreation. The purpose of belonging, centered in the navel. And the purpose of getting food for yourself to get the energy to belong to society in an acceptable way, to climb socially, to be recognized, belong to the corporate body of humanity, and to get the energy to procreate and extend your flag all over the world. So we can say to a person in trouble, is your trouble centered in thwarted food getting? That is, energy acquiring in the widest sense. Is somebody cutting across your income, your intake of food or money or clothes or housing or reputation? Or is your problem that you can't belong? Do people exclude you from their circles? Or is your problem one of impotence, one of sexual incapacity? We have three questions we can ask ourselves, which will help the person to clarify. He may say, now I've got all those, I'm quite good in all three levels. I belong very well, I get well fed, I've got plenty of money, my sex life is marvelous, and I still feel terrible. If that is so, we have to climb up into another sphere. And in this sphere we have the zone of liking and disliking, which has no material object at all. There's a millionaire friend of ours who has a very good sexual performance. He belongs very, very well to the Rotarians and the Freemasons and Mary's Own. He eats well to the tune of 21 stones. So he has no problem down there. But he has what he calls strange yearnings to go beyond this. And you say, where to? He says, I don't know. Now, in this zone of the feeling life, it is possible to like and dislike things that don't exist. We can call this the level of the romantic. Down here is the rebel of the gross material, the rebel there. And here in the mid region is the romantic level, which has no concrete object whatever. Here in this realm we can have, like Cleopatra, immortal and infinite yearnings, undefined yearnings, and they may be for strange worlds beyond our own. We actually find people hoping they'll be alive when the first rockets get to that funny planet over there, in case there are some very luscious beings on there. We don't know what shape they are, what colour their hair. We'll be sure they're lovely. We have the evidence of Adamski for that beauty. In this romantic level, we can have no limits whatever to our yearnings. On the positive side, we can yearn infinitely without any concrete object whatever. And therefore, if this man is totally satisfied in the lower region, we can say, have you got any infinite undefined yearnings? And he'll say, yes, I think I have some of those. And we can then see whether they're realizable in his lifetime, considering there is not much space in Gagarin's little rocket. Now, on the negative side, instead of the eternal infinite yearnings undefined, there are the eternal and infinite terrors undefined. the horrors and nightmares that nobody can describe, the unbelievable thing that sits on your chest and stops your breathing and paralyzes you, the thing that makes your blood stand still and scream noiselessly to be wakened up and you can't. All those are on the negative side of this undefined, infinite, negative terror. So, we say, all right, if you've not got infinite yearnings, have you got infinite, undefinable nightmares? Frequently he says, yes, but I think it's because I eat too much. But then we're moving towards some sort of resolution of the problem, if this happens to be so. But if we find he has no infinite yearnings unsatisfied and no infinite terrors threatening him, then we have to climb in the head. And we have to look at his five-pointed sense beta mechanism. We have to look in his head and see if there are not in his head some ideas that keep saying things ought to be so, which are not so. He may have a head full of ideas that say so-and-so should not be. There may be a fellow who actually finds that when one of his eyes turns out and sees a beautiful girl, when he sees her, a message immediately goes and says, you shouldn't be looking. And he sends a message straight down here and says, don't you dare do that. Now this kind of message can be a nuisance because it may be quite invalid. If the girl is beautiful, there is no reason why she should not be looked at. If she belongs to somebody else and you don't want to be a socially disruptive force, you might rationally decide to leave it alone because there's another one just as nice around the corner. But if you think you shouldn't look at beauty wherever it is, then you are suffering from an erroneous idea. Beauty is for looking at. It's a kind of food for the eyes. But if you remember what Christ said about the man looking with lust upon a woman, he has already committed it in his mind. Christ is saying this. He's not saying don't look. He's saying do not differentiate between the will in your heart to do something and the actual deed. If you do it mentally and then lack the physical opportunity, you're just as much in the act as if you had had the opportunity. He doesn't say whether the deed is good or bad. He says that the mental act is the same as the physical act, in every real sense to the inner man. Nevertheless, beauty is to be looked at. And nevertheless, the whole man has to be coordinated. The man who wants to coordinate himself won't stop looking at beautiful things. He will merely make quite sure that he doesn't run away with them all, unless he has a very large pocket. Inside this head, there are whole piles, volumes of data from experience. This data is normally not filed properly, not analyzed, not distinguished, not differentiated, but it continuously shouts down, you can't do that. So we find a very fruitful source of trouble in misunderstood philosophical concepts, misunderstood religious ideas, misunderstood socio-political concepts, and so on. In the head we find loads and loads of misunderstood concepts. The misunderstanding of these causes them to act incorrectly, to stop the romantic infinite yearnings and fears, to stop the food leap, the belonging instinct and the sexual life, all on an erroneous basis. Now, by means of a question scheme, we can always clarify to a person what part of him is at fault. And then we are to remind him that he's not only a three-part man, he's got a spine at the back of it all. He is to coordinate himself sooner or later. Somehow he's got to balance these three zones in order to make himself into one man instead of a battlefield. So when we come to try to help somebody, we pass from a fact of the whole truth, we divide the whole truth properly, into fixed eternals and differentiating temporals. And we assert that time is exactly as valid as eternity, that eternity is not nicer or cleaner than time, that there is nothing in time that doesn't come from eternity, that there's no chemical stink from Trafford Park or somewhere that has not come out of eternity, It is simply an abstraction, a partial, a differentiation of an eternal possibility. Now, in Zen Buddhism, this is stated in the same way that the symbol of the fool in the Tao states. If you must differentiate at all, do so accurately. If you haven't the time to do this, then don't define at all. Don't define eternity as valid and temporality as non-valid, but just get on with your life, because there's something in you fixed and something in you moving. And somehow this fixed and this moving are both equally valid. Then all the moral dogmas of the head are no more valid than the basic impulses of the body. Somehow the confusion in the head has to be sorted out. It has to be seen that a so-called moral concept to do with sex is basically a matter of economy of energy expenditure and a matter of hygiene, and a matter of the diversion of a man from coordination into one specific pleasure-bound function. But the funny thing is about sex. Looked at straight, it has no power to bind us at all. But looked at through funny eyes which condemn it, it gets hold of a glamour that doesn't belong to it. It is forbidden fruit. You can actually think it's worth getting, worth pursuing, simply because you're not allowed to have it. In a certain sense, an old tradition about demons inventing the rules against sex is true. Certain people who were not reproducing as much as they might were told on no account to put their minds below their waists. And this immediately made their freedom center rush out and say, whatever we do, we must spend all our time below the diaphragm. This caused a rapid acceleration of the population of certain areas. And we found it with Hitler, that whenever a nation wants to increase its population, it deliberately alters the moral code. The Hitler Youth movements were specially devised to increase the population of Germany, to make Germany overcrowded, to justify the demand for more Lebensraum. Illegitimate babies were actually encouraged. Any girl, as soon as she was old enough to conceive, could conceive within the Nazi Party in the name of the Fatherland, was blessed, because Hitler had a very clear view: I want a demand for Lebensraum to be justified by an increase in population. The only way I can do it is by increasing the population. So we see that many of these moral codes are man-made. And we have to distinguish between the man-made moral code and the eternal, fixed, formal fact of relation. There is nothing the matter with the stomach. But if it interferes with your coordination, so that you devote yourself entirely to stuffing it, forget you've got a chest and a head, something has gone wrong. There is nothing the matter with belonging to groups of people. But if your will to belong is so great that you just merge and splurge and lose your identity, again you've lost your possibility of coordinating and becoming the whole truth in yourself. If sexuality diverts you and wastes your time excessively, then again it cuts across coordination. And we are here in the time process serially presented with those things which sharpen our mind and put us in a position of being able to choose to become reflexively self-conscious. And it is this we are aiming at. Anything whatever that furthers the growth of reflexive self-consciousness and responsibility of the individual is good. Anything whatever that cuts down on reflexive, subconscious, individual responsibility is bad. When we then come to examine the relation between a man and his wife, perhaps, in trouble, we always find a very simple thing. Both are identified with a concept in the somatic zone, that is to do with body comforts, body ambitions, and so on. No energy gets from center through there without being interfered with by that concept, and there is literally a somatic war of concepts. That war in the man and his wife is a war of matter, a somatic war of bodies fighting to utilize each other. A And to help people, we have to say to one or both partners, don't utilize the body of your partner in any way to secure your own comfort or pleasure. But recognize that the center of that partner is free and is giving orders to fight everything that destroys its freedom. Recognize this free impulse is in both of them. Honor that free impulse, and the problem begins to resolve itself immediately.
Could I ask one question? Could you equate the idea that if one commits an idea mentally, it is the same as committing the deed, and the idea that intellectualism is one of our enemies, and that any ideas we have not backed by material action will be useless to us?
It's a very easy one, that one. If we say that the intellect of a man are immense processes, in the crown of intellectualism there is no intent of will to mean it. Whereas in the inner lusting after the beautiful lady, there is every intent of will. And in one case, the intellectual keeps all his concepts on the perimeter. And when somebody speaks, his perimeter reacts and says something very clever. But there is no intent of will behind what he says. But in the other case, when his deep will looks out, it looks straight across the barrier of his mind and intellect, and it looks at something it wants to appropriate. Now, it is in the will that the committal is. And this is precisely the thing we don't get in an intellectual. This is the argument and the basis of the Luther position, well illustrated in the play with Albert Finney, where Luther suddenly discovers that death should live by faith, not by words. It is a matter of the deep will, and faith has to do with that. And you can live by will. It doesn't matter how many times you make a mistake. If you allowed your intellect to condemn you because you made a mistake, you've been imposed upon by form. This is the meaning of eternal self-forgiveness. You can fall flat on your face an infinity of times, and at the end of it you must stand up. Otherwise you're being dictated to by form. And form is only a product of will. If you commit the will into it, you've done the deed, lacking only the opportunity. And if you only commit the intellectual side to it, you've committed literally nothing except form, superficial observance. It's certain that if you commit the will and then the physical opportunity is presented, the deed will be done. Whereas if you only commit the intellect, the opportunity can be presented every day and nothing will be done.
Disregard for law in your definition tonight, and free law.
Yes, and so is eating food. Perhaps even more obviously so, because food doesn't need to cooperate with you. You take the lettuce out of the ground and you just start chewing it, you don't ask permission. Or you take your snails and you don't ask permission. Or you take your ox and tie its head down and slaughter it and eat it and so on. Whatever you do, you don't ask permission. It's the most obvious appropriation of other beings. But in the sex act, I'm assuming a normal sex act between human beings, there is no appropriation as from man to goat. It is most obvious. But the thing is apparently by mutual consent. But because of the deep-lying conceptualization of comfort mechanisms and material ambitions, there may be really no sexual consent at all in the partners.
Yes, well, if we take, for instance, the act of, if we see it as simply an act of reproduction, which is really self-regard, using it in the sense that it guarantees our future comfort and security.
Active reproduction doesn't guarantee anything for us, except trouble.
we hope to make a try.
That's the concept. The individual man who's trying for a baby, he's trying for a baby because he's got to. But if he thinks he is trying for a baby as an individual, he has a concept that he must perpetuate himself as an individual. And that's already an erroneous idea. There's a fun little bit of a program, I think it was in Chesington tonight. Was it last night or the night before? My dear Tom Margerson was yet in there. Some new book about who is fit to breed. And the suggestion was that some of us are fit to breed and others are not. We have to stop those who are not and do it ourselves. It's our duty. Brilliant, beautiful and intelligent to breed. And all the people we define as unintelligent, ugly, and so on, must not be. The interviewer, I think it was Eric Hart, looked rather sharply and said, how do we know just who is fit and in what way? How do we know? Can we really take a man's brain to bits, see how much of it's going to transmit by heredity? Do we really know what does transmit at all? Can we tell whether this particular new departure is a mutant going to produce monsters or a mutant producing a messiah? We have no men. Hitler was a little more intelligent when he started breeding lunatics together to see if they couldn't, he could have made and produce one sensible man out of them. It's a little more rational to do that rather than to try to select a perfect human type, because that type has to be selected by somebody already imperfect. It's like the infallibility of the Pope, which is defined for him by a very infallible council. We have no method of knowing who ought to marry whom, unless we're going to make some very, very crude divisions like syphilitics should not marry. And even there, there's some doubt about that. There have been some experiments even in that field to see whether you cannot create antibodies. We don't know, and any attempt to force a reproductive scheme on the human race is sheer cheek and conceit on the part of the few who consider themselves very healthy people. I know one particular book that says any man with less than 32 teeth has no right to reproduce his kind. I wrote him a little letter and he said, did you know that traditionally Buddha was supposed to have 40 teeth?